Succession number 20456, reel 29.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 29. When you were on your way to Korea, passing through London, you mentioned that you met the Queen and that the Queen discussed Bricksmith with you. Do you remember anything of what she said about that?
So I'm not with you on this one.
In your narrative, you say that you went to a regimental party in London en route to Korea.
Yes, that is true. It was a luncheon, and one very briefly, introduced Sugar by the Hand, and I can't remember what was exchanged, but it was something about going back to Korea. It was of no great significance or importance.
You said that when you were offered the post in Korea, it was unexpected and came as something of a shock.
It was.
What did you expect it to be doing after your tour in Bricksmith?
I was on... The way the army works is after a certain period and after you've done certain jobs, you get on to certain lists for promotion. And I knew, because I'd been told by the then commander-in-chief in Germany, General Shan Hackett, that I was on the Major General's list.
Yes.
And, it was just a question of hoping for a gap in a particular appointment.
A vacancy.
So, as a two-star general. But there wasn't one, and so they did the next best thing for me, as it were.
Before you went out there, you had briefings in London. Do you remember what was in those briefings?
Indeed. First of all, we had a General Foreign Office briefing as to British foreign policy in the Far East. We then had a splendid morning on security, including a lecture and practical demonstration by an ex-burglar on how easy it was to break into locks and suitcases and briefcases and things, and how one could leave small trails around that would aid evildoers. And I little expected that a lot of it would come through. We were going to be well and truly burgled when we were in Korea. But that was not in my house. That was actually on an official visit.
In the hotel?
Yes.
Do you remember what they said about the main lines of British policy in the Far East at that time?
Well, yes. Korea was a bit of an embarrassment. We'd gone in there, we'd done our stuff, but we'd left a small detachment behind. And because the war was not over, it was in a state of armistice, there was still a call on the Commonwealth as such for a sort of presence there, both for reinforcements and on the actual armistice commission. And by protocol, the British brigadier was head of the Commonwealth liaison mission and had a seat at the top armistice table.
Was there a reinforcement plan in the Ministry of Defence at that time?
If there was, I didn't know it, but we had good liaison with Singapore communication-wise and through the naval attaché in Tokyo with the Navy. So at least we had Australians, New Zealand. So clearly there was something. If they wanted to, they had something to build on. I had no details of any plan, any reinforcements, anything like that. No.
Do you remember if the Foreign Office or MOD in London gave you any idea of what they thought the risks and threat were in Korea at the time?
Well, I don't think any of us really knew it. North Korea was a pretty unstable place, and it had been making some very warlike noises indeed In fact, there was shooting going on, varying from small sniping to major incidents. The Blue House raid, where some 30 very brave young North Koreans got right into Seoul. They got within 200 yards of the president's palace, and luckily something went wrong, and so you had a gun battle in the middle of Seoul. And then you had the Pueblo, the seizure of an American warship.
That had happened before you arrived, hadn't it?
Just before I arrived. But I mean, these things have been going on for some time.
Did you get advice on any sort of general line to take on that sort of thing from the FO or MOD?
It was a funny bit of advice in some way. The British didn't really want to know. We had better things to think about than goings on in Korea. And one's sort of brief was, for goodness sake, yes, tell them we're right behind them, but rather a long way. It was something, it was like a sort of boil that the doctor didn't want to know about. You know, for goodness sake, let's hope it'll get better on its own.
Forget about it and hope it'll go away.
Exactly.
Was there a similar sort of attitude in Singapore at headquarters?
Well, Singapore were running to orders from the Foreign Office. And, of course, in those days we were considering withdrawing from the whole of that part of the world, beginning to.
It was under debate, wasn't it, whether or not we should maintain a permanent garrison east of Suez?
Yes, it was.
What was the thinking in Singapore at the time? Were they in favour of the idea of a permanent presence, or did they think it should be a capability for deployment?
I think it was very split. I would have said the services would probably have liked to have stayed there, provided that they could have, you know, raised the money to do it. And equally, without in any way downgrading the local Malays, Chinese opinions of them. After all, once the confrontation with Indonesia was over and the emergency in Malaysia was over, what really were we doing there? It was nice having a garrison there, but, you know, facing people and training and so on, but we weren't really performing any useful function by then.
What about Hong Kong? I mean, they're a bit closer to Korea. Did they have a similar sort of...
Well, I was under direct command, as it were, of Hong Kong. The GOC Hong Kong was very much my direct link with the higher command.
This is General Worsley. This is General Worsley.
Only for a short time.
Short time.
He then was replaced by General Sir Basil Youth.
Yes.
Worsley was there for maybe 2 months when I was in Korea. That was all.
But presumably he briefed you on your way out.
Very much so, yes.
Do you remember anything of what he said?
Much the same, you know. It was all going down the line, you know. Glad to have you there. Do what you can, you know. Keep the British flag flying, but for God's sake, don't get us involved in anything.
Now, at that time, there was trouble bubbling up in China with the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution starting.
Well, there had been trouble in Hong Kong about 4 months before we got there. There was quite considerable trouble, and we luckily dealt with it, I think, rather well. The Chinese menace was a very different one to when we were there in the 1950, when, having come back from Korea and we were manning the frontier, I mean, there were quite large bodies of armed Chinamen, you know, in very close contact with us. There was the original exchange of desultory shots.
On the frontier.
On the frontier. This was 1950-51. By 1968-70, that had long since passed over.
Was there any idea in headquarters Hong Kong that the turbulence caused by the Cultural Revolution might spill over into Korea and destabilize it?
I don't think I was aware of that, or if it was ever considered. The trouble, there was turbulence enough in Korea without any Chinese assistance. In my view, the Chinese were in many ways acting as a brake on Korea. They did not want to get North Korea involved in any massive shoot-up with the South and the Americans.
Would it be fair to say that similarly the Americans were acting as a brake on the South Koreans?
How are they?
The Americans were acting as a brake on the South Koreans.
Also true. Oh yes, very much so. Very, very, very much so. There were certainly in the Pueblo incident, the Americans put the brakes on very hard on South Koreans.
You mentioned that when you arrived in Seoul, you were immediately involved in a great deal of diplomatic activity and protocol. This was something new to you, wasn't it? This was something quite new to you.
Not really. We'd had it in Berlin. It was, how can you put it? Berlin orientalized, you know. One was dealing with, in some ways, a bigger situation than Berlin, in some ways.
And you were more remote from assistance, weren't you?
That's
You're out there on your own.
Absolutely none. No.
What did the embassy then tell you about the situation when you arrived? Was there anything?
Nothing new.
Nothing new.
Their main job was, in those days, trade. For example, we were putting in a new railway signalling system to one of our main lines. There was a lot of Korean trade was expanding at a vast rate by the late 60s, early 70s. It really was beginning to take off, and naturally the British wanted to be in on it.
Did they think that South Korea was stable?
Yes, but yours, it was a military dictatorship, and although technically it had a parliament and a speaker and all the rest of it, the opposition didn't amount to all that much. Every company was run by, it seemed to be run, by an ex-general, you know. Well, all right, they were the only people in those days that had the experience and the ability to look after big concerns. Yeah.
Did the embassy think that the government in the North might be planning any sort of major action against the South?
The embassy was very wary indeed of what the North might do, because Kim Il-sung was an unstable character himself. He was supporting an enormous army, an air force, with very little economic background. I mean, the rest of the country could starve, as far as he was concerned, as long as he produced this very, very considerable force.
Did they think there might be any threat to his control of the North? Did they think that his control of the war might be undermined or threatened in any way as a result of that?
Well, the problem was what would happen if he was going to die. And would we have a power struggle? And how would they cover that one up?
Was he grooming his son at that time?
Because later one heard about the son and so on. Yes, very much so. One heard the son was being trained up to do all this.
You had three jobs, really, didn't you, in Korea?
Well, you had defence attaché, which was reporting on the general strength of the both American and Korean armies, North Korean armies. You then had this administrative job, which was commanding the Commonwealth Liaison Mission, which was the toehold. Because we had Australians and New Zealanders and Canadians in it. And then one had the actual job at Pan Mudjam as representative of the Commonwealth.
Did these chains of command ever get entangled in any way?
No.
You were able to keep them separate?
No. There was no clash.
What impression did you get of the South Korean forces when you were there?
Well, they were very good. The difference between the South Korean forces in 1968 and what one saw in 1950, you wouldn't have thought they were the same army. It was funny because you had American technology and training over Korean temperament and what you might call almost Japanese traditions, because most of the senior officers of the South Korean Army had originally been trained by the Japanese as very young officers, admittedly. They had mostly been to Japanese academies.
How would you describe the Korean temperament?
That's frightfully difficult. Well, first of all, they're very highly educated, much higher. Education is the big thing. They're very musical. In some ways, I've heard them described as the Irish of the Far East. You never quite know which way they're going to jump, as it were. They are hidebound by protocol. They store great pride in good manners and, how can you put it, behavior. On the other hand, they have a residue of hardness, toughness, and brutality, all mixed up. They were unlike any other Asiatic I'd ever come across before.
What was it that was distinctive then that set them apart?
Well, they're Central Asian, you see. I find them very difficult. I'm very fond of the Koreans. They're delightful people. I would not like to be on the wrong side of them. You saw the difference between the behavior of the North Koreans, who you saw at Panmunjom, who are after all the same race as the South Koreans, and you saw the tough, brutal side coming out.
Do you think that the American system of training suited them? Did they take to it easily?
Well, they had a modest vivendi with them. Trouble with the Americans was that they tended, many of them, to live in their camps and never go outside. And that included some highly educated ones. You know, everything they had was inside the camp. They didn't want to know. The mixture with Koreans was, you know, any form of self-mixture. was not encouraged. This did not apply to the people I was working with because we were combined with Koreans, nor did it apply to the Americans who were attached to Korean units, who got on very well with them indeed. But I sometimes used to think the Americans weren't awfully good at getting on with the Asiatic races. On the other hand, you have the incredible example of General MacArthur, who was absolutely brilliant at it.
Yes, but he was not normal, was he?
No, he wasn't. I mean, but he was brought up, his entire upbringing was Far East. He hardly lived in the United States. Yeah. True.
You said that you were a sort of open spy as defence attaché, and you were getting information about all the armed forces in the peninsula.
Well, certainly, because one wanted to know the nuclear capabilities of the Americans, because they alone held it. That was the problem when Pueblo was attacked. The Americans were restraining the South Korean Air Force for going in. What were their own aeroplanes armed with? Nuclear bombs. Well, that wasn't much use in that particular occasion. So they had a considerable nuclear capability in Korea and Japan, both by air and by rocket, which was in their hands entirely. There were one or two Korean artillery units who had rockets, but what they were armed with, I never really knew, or whether they could be nuclear armed, and that was kept a pretty dark secret. The Americans, I think, were pretty loath to let any form of nuclear capability in the hands of South Koreans.
So you didn't discover whether the South Koreans might have had access to nuclear warheads for their...
No. That was...
And did the Americans have nuclear shells as well for their heavy artillery?
I think they got rather out of... I don't remember them having any of those big guns then. I can't remember.
You said that on the Armistice Commission you were on the top table, but there were occasions when you were left out of some of the briefing and planning sessions. Presumably questions of nuclear armament were...
No, the only time we were left out was the business of the recovery of the Pueblo crew, because that was entirely an American...
Yes.
The Americans wanted to keep the South Koreans out of it. Mm-hmm. And so it was entirely an American North Korean affair, with the Swiss and the Swedes helping. And so we never attended any Pueblo briefings at all.
This was bilateral. Right. It was kept bilateral.
It was kept entirely bilateral.
What did the British contingent do? You mentioned that you had about 30 soldiers in Korea.
They basically were sort of ceremonial camp guards. Yes, they took their turn in patrolling the base camp on the demilitarized zone, which we used to confer in before we went to our meetings, Panmunjom itself. Mm. They used to act as military police at Panmunjom. They occasionally took part in the odd exercise. They were a tiny little British Army nucleus just to show the flag.
And you mentioned a Turkish contingent. What were they up to?
Same sort of thing. We had both Turks and Thais. In your sort of guard of honour started off with an American platoon, and then you had this composite platoon of British, Turks and Thais, and then you had a platoon of Koreans.
And you mentioned that you had two Ethiopian officers who were very exotic indeed. What were they up to?
God knows.
one should not say this, they ran away with a lot of pain in the neck. Nothing.
Why were there pain in the neck?
Well, they sort of decoyed Korean girls inside the camp for their mutual entertainment, you know. They had nothing to do, you see. They had no operational job. They were there just to show the flag. Yeah.
What about the Turks? Were they all right? Did they behave themselves?
The Turks, they were a splendid dog. I mean, so much so that they would appear on Anzac Day. And they would say to the Australians, please do not leave us out. We're part of it, aren't we? And, you know, we're received as honored guests. They're very proud of Anzac Day, the Turks. Of course, it was the start of their modern nation.
Indeed. Yes.
You know.
Well, Mustafa Kemal was there, wasn't he?
Mustafa Kemal led the counterattack, yes. Mm.
How did the Australians respond to that? Did they receive the Turks?
They loved it. Mm. Yeah, they got on very well.
Were there any Australian and New Zealand troops?
Not troops, no, officers, officers and NCOs, yes. Mm. And occasionally an Australian or New Zealand frigate would visit us.
Yes, yeah. Making port calls.
Yes, yeah. Then there'd be a party and they'd come ashore.
You mentioned the first meeting of the Armistice Commission at Panmunjom, that the North Koreans were complaining about an incident in the demilitarized zone. Do you remember what the incident was?
No. It was some minor shoot-up of really no account. Mm. When I first went out there, it was in the aftermath of Pueblo. Mm. And meetings were being held pretty frequently, I mean twice a week. Because the North Koreans still had the crew as prisoners, and they were still smarting from the fact that the Blue House raid had gone wrong, and life was tricky.
What did you actually have to do at those meetings? Were you just present as a member?
By one's first one, one's very like a new boy at the prep school. You sat and with mouth agape, listening to this. If you can imagine, you see, you call the meeting, and if you call the meeting, you made the first statement. The first statement might last, say, 10, 15 minutes, laying out why you call the meeting. It was then translated into Korean. It was then translated into Chinese. Well, that took another 30 minutes. So, having sort of served the ball over the net, it was 45 minutes before you got the return of service. So you can imagine this is why these meetings would drag on so long, particularly when they really got out of it. You had some of these statements would last half an hour.
Did you ever initiate a meeting personally?
The what?
Did you ever initiate such a meeting?
Did I ever? No, I was not. I had to keep my mouth shut. One sat, you could pass notes to the senior. As you got more and more senior, as it were, you remembered things that had been said in the past and all the rest of it. And if the North Korean side made a statement, it was absolute cock, you could just pass a note to whoever was a senior officer general and say, tell the secretary to look up meeting number so-and-so. I know very well that this was a totally direct contrast of what they said then. Because behind you, at your big table, was a mass of secretaries and translators and people who, armed with armfuls of papers and files, could look up what had been said in the past.
How did the Chinese behave at these meetings?
Well, there were only two of them, and they sat apart in some ways from the North Koreans. I never heard them utter a word. They wore no badges of rank in those days. They wore quite nicely cut uniforms. I mean, they weren't in sort of